Let's go ahead. Let's jump back into our study here. Of course, last week we began looking at Acts 17, and we're going to finish that up this evening. In our previous study, we looked at about the first 15 verses, verses 1 through 9. We talked about Paul's travel to Thessalonica and then on to Berea. In verses 10 through 15, that's where we looked at that popular verse where it talks about how the Bereans were more noble-minded than the Thessalonians. Of course, in Thessalonica, Paul and Silas ran into some issues. And then as they got into Berea, they were very successful at the beginning. And some of the Jews from Thessalonica traveled to Berea. They caused some problems there, which then causes Paul to move on. As we ended our study last week, we noted that Paul moved by himself on to Athens while Silas and Timothy stayed behind in Berea. We also noted that at some period in there, Luke doesn't give us this record, but we know that Timothy will go on back to Thessalonica and spend some time there as well. While that's going on, Paul's in Athens, and that's what we're going to look at this evening. And then what happens as a result of that, Paul goes on to the Areopagus, or it can be transliterated into Mars Hill. It's talking about the same area known as Mars Hill. And that's what we'll look at and spend our time on tonight. So as we look back, we've seen Paul and Silas travel from Antioch. They've come up through this area, up through Mysia, Troas, and sailed across. And of course, we spent some time in Philippi and in Thessalonica here and in Berea. And now Paul has traveled all the way down to Athens. So he's pretty good distance from where he was before. And he's come down the coast and down here to Athens. So now the gospel has moved from Macedonia and now into Achaia. And so Paul is able to, he's covering a wide, much wider area than he did on his first journey, of course, which was down here. And so that's what we're going to get into this evening. All right, so Paul traveling to Athens. Let's go ahead and read a little bit here. Let's start in verse 16 and read through verse 18. Now while Paul was waiting for them at Athens, his spirit was provoked within him as he saw that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and devout persons, and in the marketplaces, and in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. Some of the Epicureans and Stoic philosophers also conversed with him, and some said, "What does this babbler wish to say?" Others said, "He seems to be a preacher of foreign deities," because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection. So you have Paul here in Athens. Now, a little bit about Athens. Most people have heard of Athens. Athens was a city that was also known as the Eye of Greece. It was known for its arts and eloquency. They also were hugely into Greek mythology. You think about Zeus and Mars, Mars Hill. Those kind of Greek mythological gods, they were very much of the Athens culture. It was commonly said that there were more gods in Athens than there were men. Now, you note that statement there. Paul's spirit is provoked within him when he saw that the city was full of idols. Now, you also note there that the spirit is the little s. It's not talking about the Holy Spirit or any kind of miraculous movement within him. But this is just Paul himself being provoked or being moved in some way when he looked around and saw all of these gods. What's interesting is we keep reading, we'll get to that in just a minute. So he sees all this, and then he begins to talk with people. Now, the first place he goes, of course, is to the synagogue. That's where he always goes if there's one there. He begins to converse with them, but not just the Jews only, but it says devout persons. So there were, of course, Gentiles there who were also interested in God and in spiritual things. And so he was doing this every day. He was out there, he was talking to people, talking about Jehovah God versus all this idolatry. And that provokes within the Epicureans and Stoics some interest. Now, anybody here know what an Epicurean or Stoic is? You ever heard? You may have heard that those terms used, or you may be familiar with that type of philosophy. Anybody heard of an Epicurean or Stoic? Yes, no, maybe so. Well, they're in Athens. They were, of course, a lot of these individuals. We talk about a philosopher. What do we talk about? What does that term mean? Before I get into Epicurean and Stoic, what is a philosopher? Do we have philosophers today? Okay, who would be a philosopher? Okay, somebody likes to talk. Okay, turn on the radio and listen to talk radio, or go to Facebook, go to YouTube. There are lots of philosophers. A lot of political philosophers, a lot of life philosophers. A lot of individuals who make a living, a good living, at philosophy of some sort.
I know that's a line of study, like at University of Virginia, you can take philosophy.
Yeah, I mean, it's some study, of course. Yeah, yes, ma'am.
I was just going to say, I mean, your first question on Epicurean and Stoics. I mean, Epicurean, I mean, that's a word that still, you know, you hear frequently today. And typically, today it refers to pleasure.
Okay.
Epicureans were generally more interested in pleasure, the good life, high living, you know, kind of getting all you can out of life in that way. And Stoics typically, I mean, when you talk about somebody being stoic as far as in their demeanor, you know, they're very solemn, and typically Stoics generally just look at life as, you know, it's full of pain and trials and you just roll with it. That's life. I mean, they're kind of not hopeless, but this is just what life is, and you endure it, you know, without a whole lot of drama and complaining, typically.
Very good. Yeah, so let's talk about the Epicureans first. You hit on a lot of what I was going to say was the Epicureans were atheists. They didn't believe in God. That sounds kind of familiar. They didn't believe in the immortal soul, at least not in the way we would think of it. They believe that when you die, basically your soul, whatever that is, becomes immaterial, that it dissolves. Thus, they have the philosophy of life that since life, there's nothing after this life, there's no ultimate judge of our lives, live your life. They regarded the greatest evil in life as pain. Now, when we talk about evil, what do we talk about? Well, we're talking about in regard to sinful activity, right? If we say something's an evil act, we are, in saying that, we're referencing the morality of it. They didn't look at pain, or I'm sorry, they didn't look at evil and good that same way. Good was pleasure, evil was pain. And so anything in your life that brought you pain, that was evil. Anything that brought you pleasure, that's good. And so they developed the mantra or motto, we live for the moment, live it up. Sow your wild oats. Rid yourself of as much pain as possible. And so that was the greatest good to them. And so they viewed life from that standpoint. Now, if you think about it, that's the ultimate end of any atheistic mindset. I mean, if there is no God, well, isn't that the ultimate end of it all? I mean, what else is there? So live life to the fullest. Get as much out of it as you can. Because this life ultimately is meaningless. And so that was the Epicureans. The Stoics were different. They were pantheist. The idea that they didn't believe in one God. They believed in lots of gods. So when Paul's walking around Athens and he sees all these idols, well, those are Stoics would have regarded each of those as important. Later on in the text, and we'll get into this in a minute, there was this idea, this inclination of pantheism was so great that they even had one idol there that said, to the unknown God. Now, what does that mean, to the unknown God? Why have an idol that says, to the unknown God? I don't want to miss a God. There may be one that I'm ignorant of. Let's cover all our bases. So not only will we serve all these other idols, now this is real important, this, all this ground we're covering now, and we'll come back to it. When Paul gets into his sermon, you will notice how Paul picks up on all of this, and he will talk about it as we move on. But so for the Stoics, they viewed evil and good in a little slightly different way. They saw pain as a natural outgrowth of life. Accept it. Resign yourself to the thought that there is pain. And yet they didn't believe in the immortality of the soul. It's kind of akin, their view of God and spirituality is a little bit like the Hindu view of God. How do the Hindus view the human spirit? Anybody know? Anybody ever studied or thought about Hinduism?
It's like a wheel.
Yeah, it's like a wheel of time. Buddhists are a little bit like this too, but slightly different. But Hindus believe in reincarnation. But they believe at the ultimate end of everything, every soul is like... it's always attached to the greater spirit. Even Native Americans had a slight view akin to this. If you watched that Blue People movie a few years ago, what was it called?
Avatar.
You know, that's the theme of Avatar. And that's kind of a Stoic view of life, at least in regard to spirituality. They practice self-denial, and they believe the goodest, the highest good in life, not the goodest, but the highest good in life was the resignation to pain and suffering. And so you can see from a Stoic mindset and an Epicurean, you're going to look at life very differently because your worldview is different. And while at the same time, looking at Paul, you can see for different reasons why they think he's a what? Well, how did they phrase, what did they call him? An idol babbler. The translation there is from a term that kind of carries with the idea of a seed picker. A babbler. And so they are, while thinking he's kind of crazy, at the same time, they're intrigued by him. And so they accuse him of being a babbler, and others a preacher of foreign deities or divinities. Before we move on, just one last thought. You notice the very end there. What was it that Paul was saying that they especially grasp onto?
What he was preaching.
Which was what?
Jesus and the resurrection.
Jesus and the resurrection. Why would that in particular grab their attention? Two reasons. Okay, they can't because they don't believe in the immortality of the soul. That whole concept to them was weird. And on top of that, who is Jesus Christ? He's God. So the Epicureans don't believe in God. That's why they say he's an idle babbler. And the Stoics believe in all kinds of gods. So who is this God that he's preaching? A God that came to the earth, that died for mankind, and rose again on the third day? That's weird. Now, to us it's not, but to them it was very strange. And so, we'll get more into this. Alright, so let's go on. I didn't mean to put that up there again. Let's go into verse 19. The text goes on to say, "And they took him and brought him into the Areopagus," that's there on Mars Hill, saying, "We know what this new, may we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting? For you bring some strange things to our ears. We wish to know, therefore, what these things mean. Now all Athenians and the foreigners who lived there would spend their time in nothing else except telling and or hearing something new." So let's unpack this just for a minute. They take him to the Areopagus. Now, I did not put that. I meant to put this here. We'll go back to that text. But the Areopagus, you can see Mars Hill here. The Areopagus would sit about here. Now there's Athens over here. And that's modern day Athens, of course. But you can tell a little bit from the picture how high up you are and how much of a view you'd have of the city. So this is up there. The mythology regarding Mars Hill. Why is it called Mars Hill? Well, Mars was a Greek god. They believe in the mythology teaches that Mars, the god Mars, was put on trial on this hill, hence Mars Hill. This was also where the Supreme Court of the day would at times meet, would be in the Areopagus. See a little bit more of a picture. We're looking right here, and you have some other bigger buildings up here, but the Areopagus would be somewhere right in here, and I just got this picture here, and you can see the steps going up, and this area up here. Was where he would speak to them. All right. They said, the text tells us, and I'll go back here. So they say, "May we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting?" Now we've looked a little bit about this Epicurean Stoic mindset. But let's back up just a little bit. Now, Paul typically, when he gets to anywhere, where does he go first?
Synagogue.
And who's there? Jews, right? And so there's a manner of preaching that he will present to the Jews who already have a framework of understanding of God's plan of salvation from the Old Testament. And so when he goes into the synagogue, where is he going to preach to them from? He's going to use the Old Testament to teach them about Jesus Christ. Just like in Acts 8, when Philip joins the Ethiopian eunuch, he's reading Isaiah 53. What does he do? Verse 35. he takes that text, a man who is familiar with the Old Testament, and he teaches him what? Jesus. So he has a certain style or a certain manner of teaching that he has with Jews. These people are very different. And what you'll notice is in his preaching, he will come at it from a very different perspective. Isn't it interesting that there are a lot... How many sermons did Paul preach? We have no idea, right? Because there were tons of them. And as the text shows us here, he's preaching every day. But yet, how many recorded sermons do we have? Very few, like four. And not even probably whole of any of them. Why does Luke take the time to record this particular sermon? If Paul had all these other ones, why this one? Was it in particular better than the other ones? I don't know, maybe. Might there be another reason for it?
It probably deviated from his usual.
What? Say it again?
It probably deviated from his usual.
How so?
And
you're right, I agree with you.
If I'm understanding, he's, like you said, he talked from the New Testament, and you said they were different. So he had to have a whole different approach, I would imagine.
If you're going to an atheist, you're going to talk to them about the existence of God, are you going to get out your Bible and start there?
No.
No? Why not?
No,
I don't believe it. There's no authority to the Bible for them at that point. I have to use a different mindset when I'm with someone like that. We've already noted that these individuals don't know about Jesus Christ. They're not Old Testament scholars or even Old Testament readers, probably, in great detail anyway. They might have, I'm sure they've heard of it, I'm sure they've read some of it. But for them, it doesn't carry the weight. But now when he's in the synagogue, he's around a bunch of people that's where the authority is, and so he's going to preach from the Old Testament. And so here, you'll notice in the sermon, he's preaching from a different mindset. Take the Gospels for a second, and I'll move on. We have how many Gospels? Four, right? The first three, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, are called the Synoptic Gospels. Why are they called Synoptic Gospels? Because they're all similar in the way they present the information. John, very different for a lot of different reasons. I won't get into that tonight. But you notice in each of those, even though those three are called the Synoptic Gospels, are they exactly the same? Why do they sometimes have different information or present details in a different way? Take, for instance, Matthew and Luke both have a genealogy. Mark does not have a genealogy in his, but Matthew and Luke do. Do you notice anything different about those two genealogies? Go back and read them. We won't do that for this class. But you will notice as you study those, they are different in kind. In Matthew's gospel, he, in his genealogy, deals with the time period between Abraham and Jesus. Whereas Luke, deals with Adam to Jesus. Why the difference? Well, Matthew's gospel was written to Jews. Mark's was written to Roman Christians. We won't get into that and why it's different than Matthew today, but he was writing to a slightly different audience. But Luke was written to Gentiles. Why does Luke go back to Adam and not Abraham? Because for Gentiles, Abraham didn't mean what he meant to the Jews, at least not in becoming a Christian, before they became a Christian, because Judaism doesn't mean anything to them. And so Matthew writes about Abraham because Abraham is the father of the Jews. And they didn't need to go back to Abraham. They already believed Adam, because they believed all that. And so you'll notice in Paul's sermon, he approaches it from a different standpoint. All right, I've said enough about that. We'll move on. Last thing here, verse 21, notes here, and then we've kind of hinted on this already, so I won't spend much, but it says, now all the Athenians and foreigners who lived there would spend their time in nothing else except telling and hearing something new. So one good thing that Paul has here is what? Listening ears. They're ready to hear. Now, one of the negatives would be they're very skeptical of anything, which there's nothing wrong in being skeptical, but you can almost be too skeptical of things. But at least here he has some listening ears. And we'll go on and continue here. So he goes to the Areopagus. It tells us, verse 22, so Paul, standing in the midst of the Areopagus, said, men of Athens, I perceive that in every way you are very religious. For as I passed along, I observed the objects of your worship. I found also an altar with this inscription, to the unknown God. What therefore you worship as unknown, this I proclaim to you. And so Paul goes there and he stands up before all these individuals, all these learned men. You know, one of the things Athens was known for was for the intellectual capability of its citizens. They loved to learn. Again, we'll go back to verse 21 there. They would sit and they would listen. They loved gathering information. So these were intellectual people, and he's going to appeal to that intellect. But he says, I perceive that in every way you are very religious. Now, I don't know if Paul meant that as a compliment or if he's saying this sarcastically. We already know that as he went around the city, his spirit was provoked in him. But it's interesting, he captures on this. So he's going to utilize an illustration they're going to be familiar with. So he looks at that altar to the unknown God, and he says, this particular idol I want to clue in on. Now, I'm sure that piqued their curiosity, both for the Epicureans and for the Stoics, because he says, I'm going to tell you who that is. And so he grabs their attention, and as we go on, verse 24, you note there, Paul begins to present his message. The God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man. Nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything. Since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything, and he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on the face of the earth, having determined and allotted periods and boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God and perhaps feel or grasp at their way toward him and find him. Yet he is actually not far from each one of us. For, verse 28, in him we live and move and have our being. Even as some of your own poets have said, for we are indeed his offspring. And one thing you'll note here, you may stand out to you, is that Paul is actually in the middle of a debate. That's one of the things they're doing in the Areopagus or in the city quite often. They have debates, and they're debating about different gods, different philosophies of life. You have the Epicurean saying, there is no God, life should be lived up. And you have the Stoic saying, no, there is many gods, and therefore you need to accept pain in life, and you need to you need to accept that and welcome it. And so you have these different mindsets battling, and Paul's entering into this debate. And he begins by, of course, he points out to the unknown God. And the first thing he notes here is the God who made heaven. Now first, he's attacking whom? Or the mindset of whom? the Epicureans, right? He's saying to you, the God who made everything, there is a God. And he's challenging that mindset. And he's going to utilize these idols as proof of that. He is the creator. Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God. God created the heavens and the earth. I've been doing a study, and be some of what I present on Sunday, but that term, Elohim, that's used in Genesis 1 in the Hebrew, that term Elohim, it comes from it's the plural form of the word El in the Greek. El literally defined as mighty. It refers to strength and to power. And so in Genesis 1:1, when Moses wrote, in the beginning God created, he's talking about the power of God. Now we talk about the love of God, the grace of God, the judgment of God, the justice of God. And all those are true, but God is not any one characteristic. And so in Genesis 1, Moses points out to us the power of God. And he describes it as he talks about each day of creation. And he begins it in verse 1. He says, in the beginning God created. One of the things that atheists cannot run away from, the question they cannot, although they try to avoid, but they cannot answer, and eventually it will catch every one of them, why is there something when there should be nothing? I don't care what singularity they talk about, how they try to remove and push back and shrink down matter, turn matter into energy. They cannot escape or evade the question of why is there something when there is nothing? Why is there something when there should be nothing? Because God, the Almighty, all-powerful God, in the beginning, created. And the Epicureans could not run away from or evade that question either. And so Paul says, the God, Yahweh, who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man. Now he's looking around. And maybe at this point he's pointing out and he's showing to them each and every one of these idols. You notice how he begins to break this down. God does not dwell in temples. God does not dwell in a church building. God does not dwell in a tabernacle or in a temple. You cannot confine God. You cannot shut him up. We don't worship in a sanctuary because God is not contained in this building. Just a place where we meet. God does not exist in those idols that you see here. Zeus cannot be God. Mars cannot be God. Mercury cannot be God. Because each and every one of them exists in an idol. That can't be God. And he goes on to say, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. Genesis 1:26, let us make man in our image. In our likeness, let us make him. Let us create him. Genesis chapter 2 describes exactly what God did. How from the dust of the earth, he formed man. And I believe it's in verse 7, it says, he breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. God created mankind. It's not the other way around. And yet when I walk through this city and I see all these gods, each and every one of them has been formed and made by the hands of man. Tell me how that's God. He made, verse 26, from one man, Adam, every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and boundaries of their dwelling place. We'll get into verse 27 in a second. Do you know, why is Adam called Adam? Anybody know? Why did God pick, or why does the Bible, why did Moses pick the name Adam? Do you know Adam is the generic Hebrew form of the term man? Why is he called man, Adam? Because he's man. Why is woman called woman? Because she comes from man. Because God took that rib and he formed Eve. And then he says, having determined allotted periods and boundaries of their dwelling place. In other words, each and every individual sitting there on Mars Hill, each and every individual sitting here and online, wherever you are, each of us has a birthday, and each of us will have a day that we die. We have an allotted amount of time. No matter how much we may want to extend that, and medicine has helped us to extend that, eventuality of each and every one of us is that we will meet that end of our life. We have an allotted amount of time to live on this earth. God is not reduced to that same time. God exists above and beyond it. Verse 27, that they should seek God, that they should seek to grasp. The ideal is grasping out in the darkness for God. God has put something in every individual, and it is a desire for God. And some deny it. Some call themselves atheists or agnostic. The reality is mankind has an innate desire for God. We were made in His likeness. In the likeness of God, He made us. And so that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way, grasp their way toward Him and find Him. The end of verse 27 is such a powerful text. Yet, He is not far from any of us. Romans 1, 19 and 20. For since the creation of the earth, His invisible attributes are clearly seen. God is not far from any of us. Even more than that, God, in the form of Jesus Christ and the Son, came to this earth. He didn't just make Himself available. But He came after us. That same God that created all mankind, left heaven to walk on the earth. This ideal, you say, that's Babel. That same message is the message that will save you. Verse 28, in Him we live and move and have our being. As even some of your own poets have said, for indeed what we are, for we are indeed His offspring. He's pointing to their own poets and saying, listen to them. God is real, and Jehovah God exists, and He's none of these things that you say He is. Next week, we'll finish this little section up and look at the rest of what Paul has to say. Any questions or comments? Powerful message. Read it. Soak it up. This is the same message that can be preached to the unbelievers, even today. Those same truths hold true to this very day. Those same unanswered questions by atheists are still unanswered and will remain unanswered because they cannot answer them outside of God. I don't need to know all the ins and outs of the Big Bang Theory and all of its weaknesses. I don't need to know about physics and quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics is their whole new thing. That's what they're trying. You heard that term, quantum mechanics? It's them trying to answer the unanswerable question, and yet they continue to fall short because the truth is still the truth. Thank you. Next week we'll finish up this chapter.